from CIA to CEO, one of the best business books has been described as. It's a manual for entrepreneurs that reveals how the esoteric, one of my favorite words, esoteric techniques of the CIA can help anyone find their voice, discover their potential, and thrive in the world of business. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from London, the woman who has written the book and indeed done it all. Delighted to say welcome to the show, Rupal Patel. Rupal, good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. When I first heard that you had been in the agency, I believe they call it, the agency, yes, and now you're working in the world of business, my first thought were, well, I bet she gets her invoices paid on time.
Yeah, sometimes I have to threaten some sort of subversive techniques, but usually they pay on time.
That's normally a good way. So tell me a little bit about then, because I think we have a preconception, mainly from Hollywood and movies and books and whatever, about what the CIA actually is. So without getting me in major trouble, Rupal, just to describe how you came to join that sort of male-dominated world, to put it mildly, and how you made it in relation to that particular sphere of esoteric investigation.
Yeah, so I was recruited out of graduate school. I was studying international affairs and also had a political science background. And I think it was a combination of just language capabilities, having lived and worked in various countries overseas, and having that curiosity about the world that made me an appealing candidate. And they asked me to apply. I applied. We went through a very rigorous background investigation. And then about a year later, I started my first day at the agency.
And I mean, you talk about, obviously there's a lot of talk about glass ceilings and the roles of women in a male-dominated industries or male-dominated structures. If you're looking for one that is, you know, back-slapping macho, boots on the ground, etc., you don't get much more macho, do you, than the CIA?
No. Well, yes and no. So, yes, there is all of that, of course, you know, sort of hyper-alpha culture. But there is a really strong undercurrent of, for lack of a better phrase, nerdiness, because as many as, you know, as we have those tough guys, those guys out in the field, the Jason Bournes and the, the James Bonds of the world, there's a whole cadre of analysts. We have a ton of scientists. We have a whole science and tech division. I mean, we've got literally there is room for everyone at a place like the CIA. And that was one of the most pleasant surprises for me, because like you and many of your listeners, perhaps I knew nothing about the agency aside from what I saw in Hollywood and in popular culture. And the reality is definitely, definitely much, much more nuanced.
I suppose the main thing about anything to do with any intelligence agency is its gathering of data. So it's not, it's not doing Ford Rolls whilst firing from the hip. It's actually the humdrum stuff. It's sifting through, collating, and being able to recognize trends and patterns and what you're doing.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the things that I loved. I mean, I sort of, to try to make sense of some of what I did while I was there, I often referred to myself as a data analyst, right? Because, or a data scientist, because again, at a place like the CIA, you are literally drinking from a fire hose of information, and being able to parse the signal from the noise is one of the things that is really, really, one that you get a little bit of help, in training in, but you develop an instinct for. And that's an incredibly valuable life skill, in general, regardless of what field you operate in, being able to say, okay, well, that's actually irrelevant data, or that source is somehow biased, or, that person's credibility is a bit shaky, et cetera. That analytical capability is something we all, use either intuitively or need to get better at, even, in our more normal jobs.
And presumably, I mean, the stakes don't get much higher. I mean, we're talking about shifting data and drinking from a fire hose. Don't try that at home, kids. But the stakes are quite something, because this is the information and your decisions and your, what's good information, what's not good information, affects government policy and therefore directly affects millions of people's lives. So, the stakes don't get much higher than doing that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the good thing is that we don't ever create policy. So our job at the agency was never to say, okay, you should do this or you should do that. It was actually just to inform policymakers and then leave it at that. So it was, hey, this is our best analysis. This is what we think about this specific topic. These are some of the blind spots or the questions we still have to answer. But this is based on, the preponderance of evidence, based on all of our biggest and brightest brains sort of chewing over this issue and trying to poke holes in the argument and make it as robust as possible. This is what we think is happening and how it's playing out. these are some potential ways forward or these are some scenarios. But hey, policymaker, Mr. President, Mr. Secretary of Defense or whoever, now it's up to you to decide what you do with that information.
And what you're doing is important stuff. And it must be a hell of an adrenaline rush as well when you're getting stuff in. So to walk away, to voluntarily leave that agency then must be quite a big decision to make. And did you find then going into the, I'm not going to call it a humdrum world of business, but did you find going, you know, back on into quote unquote normal life, if such a thing exists, did it have the same excitement for you?
No, in a word. Having said that, I think it was, you know, what I missed really in those, especially those early days or early years even of my post-agency life, was the sense of mission and the sense of camaraderie that I felt while I was there. And, you know, the sense of contributing to something bigger than myself. And it was a real sort of, I guess, an identity shift as I tried to figure out, okay, well, now I'm not, you know, I don't have this organization, this structure, et cetera, behind me. How am I going to find ways to bring meaning and a sense of purpose and a mission and something bigger than myself back into my life? And in many ways, that's some of what I discuss in the book is, you know, we all have that, I imagine, we all have a sense of what we care about or something that we're really passionate about. And the way I refer to it is untapped potential. And so, you know, a lot of what the struggle I found in my own career transitions and path is figuring out what element of that potential I want to tap into and how to bring it into the world in a meaningful way for me.
I suppose one of the things as well you've learned, which you translates into business, is planning, you know, preparation and then execution of idea.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing, though, it's all of that stuff. It's the planning, the preparation, the execution, but it's also having a very open-minded and experimental approach. Because, again, the parallels with the work at the CIA is you could plan the most perfect strategy and fill it with the most capable officers and have all of the tech and all of the gear and all of the equipment to execute it perfectly. But when that strategy meets the real world, when that mission starts being put into place and kicks off, there are all kinds of unforeseen things that happen, challenges that come your way. Sometimes it's weather patterns. Sometimes it's, you know, information that you thought was accurate isn't accurate. Sometimes it's, you know, people. Again, the similarities and the parallels in the world of business is exactly the same, right? You can have the best plan, the best managers, the best CEO, the best vision, but sometimes there will be market shocks, there will be pandemics, there will be economic crashes, there will be so many things outside of your control. And it's having the agility to just roll with those punches. And I'm dating myself here by using this reference, but I often refer to it as like the MacGyver approach to life, right? You know, you sort of find yourself in a sticky spot and you find a way out through some duct tape and a ball of string.
Oh, I didn't think we'd get a MacGyver reference, but I'm with you on that one. Don't worry about it. As they say, the Saturday evening viewing was MacGyver if you're of that age. But it's interesting because they always say, you know, no great plan survives contact with the enemy, which is always the way. So you have to be agile. Does this work that do the lessons that you're putting across with the book, do they work for any size and any structure? So if I'm a freelance graphic designer, if I'm setting up my own, you know, my own bookshop, if I want to do a service industry, if I want to run a garage, do the same principles work for any size business? It doesn't have to be an organization the size of the CIA, for example.
It works for any and every aspect of life. So not just business and careers. It could be, yes, as you said, whether you're running a garage or a coffee shop or, you know, a multi-billion dollar corporation, the fundamentals of high performance, of mindset, again, of agility, of leadership, all of these things are exactly the same. And it's also true in our personal lives. You know, some of the things that I talk about in the book around having difficult conversations or how you plan sort of your own life and what the bigger picture of it's going to the strategy of your life, not just your career, but everything else that makes, you know, life worth living. So it's a highly adaptable, and I've kept it, you know, I think it's Einstein who said to keep things as simple as possible, but no simpler. So that's what I've tried to do. But yes, the tools and the the frameworks are totally usable in any aspect of life.
But it's interesting to say mindset, because we've seen, I mean, one of the things that drives me mad on social media, and that's another conversation, but hey, is the fact that we always say people, you know, I'm not sure these people are saying, go and follow your passion, you know, your passion, which is great. And, you know, we can all have passion, but we kind of live in a situation now where people want the instant hit. They want that instant success. They want that instant gratification. And if it doesn't work, they just drop it and walk away. And presumably, you've been trained is the fact that you've got to do the hard yards. There isn't an instant hit. It doesn't work like that.
No, there, you know, to, again, sort of keep it as simple as possible, but no simpler. You have to be a trier. You cannot just let your obsession with, okay, well, I want this immediately, or this is what other people have gotten after this amount of time, and assume it's going to be the same. Your reality, the way it's going to work for you, will sometimes, oftentimes be incredibly different. So you just got to keep trying. There is no magic sauce. There is no overnight success. And the reality with things like social media is, all of those people that we see on social media and we think, oh, wow, they've got millions of followers, or we think they're an overnight success. You only see them after they've broken the momentum, after they've put in the hard yards, after they've spent 10 years to become that overnight success. And so it's to just, you know, have that, I guess, patience, but also that resilience of, it doesn't matter how long it takes for me to get to this goal or this ambition. I'm going to keep trying until I get there. And the reality is, whether it takes 1 year or 10 years is totally arbitrary. And so, you know, you should have, I guess, some sort of goalpost that you set for yourself. But, you know, like I said, whether it happens in 1 year or 10 years, does it really matter if it happens at, you know, at some point? And so I think, like I said, it's sort of take all of that you see in not just social media, in pop culture as well, with a huge lump of salt, because we get the redacted, the curated version of things, and none of the behind the scenes, oh, these are the millions of rejections I faced, or this is the, you know, the horrible experience I had with X, Y, or Z thing. And just, you know, like I said, focus on doing you. All of that other stuff is just more noise.
And also, of course, because you were there and, you know, in the agency sifting through that fire hose of information. I mean, a lot of it is, it's not all, look, I found this, you know, and rushing up to the head of department. I mean, a lot of it is what I call the grind, is the boring stuff, the paperwork, the unglamorous stuff. But you've got to have the solid foundations before you can do the flying bit.
That's exactly right. I would say about 60% of my career was the non-glamorous stuff, was, as you said, sort of just looking at the data, having conversations, you know, talking to other analysts, trying to figure out sort of, you know, the credibility of this source or the validity of this piece of analysis, et cetera. And you have to have that solid foundation, because the stakes are really high. So you want to make sure that you're doing the most that you can possibly do to make it as robust as possible. And you can't rush some of these things. A lot of things do just take time. And we have become obsessed with, like, again, quickness, fastness, speed, et cetera. And there's a huge difference between being hasty and being quick. And I think, you know, we've conflated the two. And sometimes in our rush to be quick, we become hasty, and then the results start falling apart. And it creates a really weak foundation on which you build something. So yeah, that take things slow things will take the time they take, right? You know, or the way I often talk about it is, success takes its own time. So we can have, again, the most beautiful plans and strategies, et cetera, but there's no external force being like, oh, okay, yeah, Rupal wants to do this in 1 year, so we got to make it all happen for her in 1 year. It takes its own time.
And when you ask around, were you kind of surprised about people who maybe have a plan for their business but then have a plan for their lives? Because we tend to be reactive rather than proactive in our personal lives as well, rather than saying it.
It's interesting. There's this, and some of it, again, is just the way many societies are constructed, the separation of work and life. And I'm putting it in quotes, because there is no separation between, quote unquote, work and life. Your work is a part of your life, and your life, in order to live it, you know, you need to do some work, right? So I think this whole idea of work-life balance and, you know, treating things as compartmentalized aspects of our lives has some resonance and some relevance, but we shouldn't be creating silos. And I think there are too few people who recognize that you can't just be one-sided. You can't just put, you know, 100% in one thing and then let yourself totally down in another area of your life. And, you know, I see this sort of, I joke about this, but you see a lot of times, like, accountants whose personal finances are a total mess, or, you know, the joke is like hairdressers have horrible hair themselves, right? It's they're better at the doing than they are for others than they are for themselves. And so, yeah, that disconnect I find really strange. And that's, again, why I intentionally wrote the book, in order to make it life skills. It's not just about career and, you know, success in a very sort of quantifiable way. It's the bigger picture strategic view of your life, and your career is just one part of it.
And I'm not saying that we should have, you know, perfectly coiffed hair at all times, and but you are. I can talk. I'm sitting here with absolutely no hair on my head whatsoever. But you go out there, and whether you like it or not, if you're the owner of a small business, a big business, a medium, you are the business. So you are presenting the front of the business, and it's quite amazing how many people don't want to do that bit, and they sit there going, well, I'm not. I put something out on social media, but nobody's coming out. But the actual, again, military thing, boots on the ground, getting out and meeting people in person and saying, this is what I do.
Yeah, well, it's two things. So there's the superficial side of it, which we all would like to think, oh, well, you know, how you look doesn't matter, and, you know, people are, you know, shouldn't judge you, et cetera, et cetera. We're all too grown up to be dealing in shoulds here, right? So yes, things should be a certain way, but the reality is they're not. And humans do just instinctively judge other humans within the first few seconds of meeting them. And so you have to either actively choose to completely go in the face of that and say, I do not care, and own the repercussions of what not caring will mean, and maybe not being taken as seriously, or maybe not getting customers. Or you can say, look, I'm willing to just put my physical best foot forward and try, because the reality is not, you know, sort of that whole thing of like, what you see is what you get. It's what they see is what you get. So what other people see is how you get treated. And again, whether this is the way it should be, or if it's fair or whatever, that's just the way human beings work. So, like I said, if you're going to take a principled view about it, then own the repercussions that come with that. And or you can use it to your advantage and just go out there and put your best foot forward on that side of things. And then sort of by extension, what you were saying is, yes, everything in life, we've become so obsessed with technology, and everything's got an app and a shortcut and some sort of way of hacking it. But the reality is most businesses are still relationship people businesses. All businesses are, right? Your customer is always going to be a human being. And particularly in the early days, but I think sort of, you know, if you want a long-term business of any size, you need to get good at talking to human beings. And you don't have to be a witty conversationalist. You don't have to be the best salesperson in the world, but you at least have to go out there and pound the pavement from time to time.
And what was it like putting all this down in a book without giving away too many secrets?
It wasn't actually that hard, because I've been thinking about so many of these things and putting them in practice for a really, really long time. And so the process of sitting down and sort of getting it out of my head and onto paper was really fluid. And you know, I always had in the back of my mind that, of course, you know, the book will have to go through a review process at the CIA, because, of course, we, you know, have a lifetime requirement to protect the secrets we were exposed to. But they are, and I've worked with them many times now on clearing various publications. They're incredibly wonderful to work with. You give them a deadline, they respond by the deadline. They're, you know, and I think, like, you know, in my current book, they made minor suggestions. And look, that's my obligation as a former agency officer, so I don't begrudge it. And I'm glad that we have that mechanism in place, because, again, let's not be naive here, people. There are some real national security things that people will unwittingly sort of share. And you need to have that mechanism in place to make sure that we're not, as you said, giving away too many secrets, or any secrets.
Right. So without giving too many secrets away about the book, because we want them to go online and download it from our own virtual bookstore on TRE.radio.
Yeah,
but one, you know, look, give me a tip. So if I'm sitting there this morning thinking, wow, you know, this lady has more energy than Giles Brown in the morning before coffee, and that's quite something. So how do I tap into that incredible energy? What would you say a first step is, RuPaul?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think everybody obviously has different energetic profiles. And I think one of the things that has been really valuable for me, and is something I do sort of outline in the book, is this notion of a personal energy map. So we all, whether we are conscious of it or not, have different times of the day, the week, the season, the year, where we have different peaks and troughs in our energy. And it's not just feeling high energy or feeling low energy. It's there are certain times of the day when you might feel more conversational, other times of the day where you want to be a bit more reflective and on your own, other times of the day when maybe you just, you know, sort of want to knock things out and get all the, you know, tedious tasks off your desk. Whatever the case may be, we all have these energetic maps. And one of the best sort of ways of taking some of the friction out of the day-to-day grind and day-to-day sort of things that we're all confronting with and all of the many pulls on our time is to start literally mapping it out, you know, and tuning into ourselves and saying, okay, well, you know, when am I more, do I have a head for admin? When am I more, you know, sort of naturally feeling conversational and wanting to engage with people or whatever it looks like in your life? And then trying whenever possible without being, you know, dogmatic about it to map the things that you're doing or you have to do on top of where your energetic sort of, where your energies are for that type of thing. And it sounds like such a small thing to do, but it is one of the most powerful things because let's face it, we're all tired. We're all overcommitted. We're all oversubscribed and have millions of different hats we're wearing and constantly shifting from, you know, thinking about one thing to another. Anything that we can do and that we sustain for a long time, that to take some of that friction out, to take some of the there's just the tension and the, yeah, I guess friction is the best way of putting it, is worth doing because it just, these things compound over time. And that's one of the things that I think will help you leverage your own, will make it easier for you to reach whatever goals you have if you're not constantly working in opposition to where your sort of energy levels are.
The book is called From CIA to CEO. I love the title, by the way. It's by Rupal Patel, who we're speaking to today. If people want to find you online, I know that you're on Twitter. Is there a website? Where can people find out more about you and get some helpful hints?
Yeah, the best place to find me is, as you said, online on my website, which is rupalypatel.com.
The book is called From CIA to CEO. It's also available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. It's by Rupal Patel. Rupal, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.